Here on BBC Radio 4 FM, we continue our book of the week. Singer Tracy Thorn's memoir, Bedsit Disco Queen. Best known as Everything But the Girl, Tracy and her partner Ben Watt met at university in 1981 and began a personal and professional relationship that has lasted over 30 years. Today, Tracy revisits one of their darkest times. At a career low point, in 1992, Ben contracted a life-threatening illness and his near-death experience changed everything.
Our power was waning, and with it, our self-confidence. The 1980s had become a very much more conservative decade. We were at the lowest point of our entire career, the point at which it may have looked as if it was all over. We'd had a reasonable run at it, all told. The band had lasted 8 years and made 6 albums. The last one had been a bit rubbish, and we were running out of steam. Luckily, Ben decided to contract a life-threatening illness, and in doing so, saved us. On a morning in June 1992, when he was 30 years old, Ben went off for another doctor's appointment to try and get to the bottom of the mysterious symptoms that had been plaguing him for months. He'd been suffering from asthma, but asthma that got worse and worse, and was untouched by the strongest asthma drugs available. Endless visits to the GP and then to specialists seemed to offer nothing in the way of a concrete diagnosis. After Ben had been gone about an hour, he phoned me from the clinic where he had just had an ECG. "They think I might be having a heart attack," he said calmly. "Do you think you could come over?" Over the next 10 days, Ben experienced a lurching descent into what was an obviously serious, though as yet undiagnosed illness. He got gradually sicker, then suddenly much, much sicker. And meanwhile, every invasive test, all involving needles, pain and fear, came back with inconclusive but alarming results, all pointing at some kind of unidentifiable multisystem disorder. Doctors scratched their heads and said they were baffled, which is really the very definition of what you don't want doctors ever to be. Surgeons arrived, the mechanics of the medical profession, and called time on all this namby-pamby tests business, declaring that it was time to operate. "Open this man up," they said, "and let's see what's going wrong." And so one morning, Ben was wheeled off to the operating theatre for exploratory surgery. Unable to sit by his empty bed waiting, I took myself for a walk. When at last I returned to his room, I found 2 nurses matter-of-factly stripping his bed and sweeping the personal items from his bedside table into a plastic bag. One of them turned and caught sight of my stricken face.
"No, no," she cried, "it's not what you think. He's been taken into intensive care. Sit down, I'll get the doctor."
So not actually dead then, but in intensive care. That was nearly as bad. The doctor arrived and gave me a synopsis of what had happened. They'd found a lot of internal damage to Ben's intestines caused by a rare inflammatory condition, and he would require a lot of further surgery and medication if he was to recover. As Ben lay unconscious in intensive care, I sat beside his bed, doing jigsaw puzzles and reading P.G. Wodehouse novels, gratefully losing myself for hours in the comforting world of stories where the worst disaster that could befall a young chap was the unexpected arrival for lunch of a fearsome aunt. I'd burst out laughing at inappropriate moments, then look up guiltily to see if anyone had noticed. In the evenings, I'd sit and talk to whichever nurse was on duty. Often it was Martha. She'd hand me cups of tea and hold my hand for a bit if I was crying, and patiently listen while, for the first time ever, I talked to a virtual stranger about Ben and me and what we had together and everything it meant. When Ben wrote Patient, his book telling the story of his illness, a few people commented to me that one of the reasons it was so moving was that it was a great love story as much as it was a story about an illness. And it was a story that hadn't ever been told before, because we'd always found it impossible to talk in public about our relationship, or to describe to journalists what it was like living and working together for all those years. We often used to say in interviews that to us it just seemed normal, because it was all we'd known, and that was true. There were no stormy bust-ups in the press, or tempestuous public rows, so people often assumed our relationship was a bit too good to be true. But in reality, we'd had as many ups and downs as any other couple. There was a trip to Japan in the late 1980s, when we were sleeping in separate hotel rooms, not getting on well at all. In the middle of one night, there was an earthquake. Waking up in a gently swaying hotel, at first I wondered where Ben was. Then I remembered and thought, oh great, after all these years, we're going to perish 50 yards away from each other in a Japanese hotel. I went out and groped my way along the corridor to Ben's room. The experience had, quite literally, shaken us up a bit, and we had a word with ourselves. Often in interviews we would be asked, what's the secret of your success as a couple? And it would be impossible to answer. Recently, though, I was asked by a magazine to fill in a questionnaire about my favourite films, and while I was racking my brains for an answer, I remembered an anecdote that says something about the two of us. On one of our first dates, back in 1981, we went to the cinema, but when we got there, we couldn't agree on what to see. So Ben went into Scream 1 to see the gothic, Deliverance-style horror flick Southern Comfort, while I went into Scream 2 to see the girly option, Tess of the D'Urbervilles. We met up outside afterwards and had our date. My point being that perhaps the only secret of success in any relationship is to agree to differ. The weird hours and crazed obsessiveness of making records were also things we shared. On tour, we would watch other band members fall into a slump of loneliness, missing partners back home, feeling torn between the freedom that travelling offers and the duty not to enjoy it too much, a constant battle between solitude and guilt. We were lucky, too, in being a showbiz celebrity couple before there was really a celebrity culture. Or perhaps we were only ever a minor celebrity couple. We once glanced over the desk to check our reservation at a restaurant, only to see the words semi-VIP next to our names. We kept our heads down as much as possible and stayed under the radar most of the time. Not only had we never divorced, we'd never even got round to marrying each other, nor had we got round to having babies. And now, as Ben lay at death's door, it seemed as though we might have left it too late to do any of those things. I felt a nagging sense that we had wasted time and that I'd missed countless opportunities to shout from the rooftops about how much I bloody loved him, as if it was somehow crucial that the world know that. Ben was finally diagnosed with Churg-Strauss syndrome, an autoimmune disease which had caused vascular inflammation. Much of his small intestine had been irreparably damaged and had to be removed bit by bit in a series of operations. After the extreme danger of the first few days, Ben's condition stabilised, and though it would still be weeks before he came home, with many relapses and recoveries in between, surgery on a huge abdominal abscess, then a bout of septicemia that nearly killed him, life began to settle into a kind of routine. I spent the first week or so sleeping in the relatives' room, but then went back home and spent part of each day travelling backwards and forwards between Hampstead and Westminster. I did nothing else at all but get up, dress, travel to the hospital, sit by Ben's bed all day, go back home, eat a takeaway and go to bed. Whole days would pass when I'd barely speak to anyone and I would forget to eat, till by the end I had lost nearly as much weight as Ben, and the two of us looked like a poster campaign warning young people to just say no. In the immediate aftermath of his illness, after he had come out of hospital, Ben retreated into himself, often not speaking for hours. And when we did speak, it was to replay the events of the previous months over and over again, clutching at meaning, gruesomely fascinated by the extremity of what had happened. I would fill him in on all that had happened while he was in surgery or sedated, and tell him the things the doctors had said to me and what they'd thought his chances were. He both did and didn't want to know everything, and was drawn towards every detail, only to find that it then added another layer of horror. For a while, he cared about nothing except the narrative replaying inside his own head. He was self-centred, to a degree that I suspect is common in anyone recovering from a trauma. After a while, I welcomed the re-emergence of his old, sometimes slightly manic, self-motivation. That fighting spirit was, after all, what had kept him going in hospital, and now had him roaring up the M1 in a new sports car when he could barely walk, and would in a little while have him going back on tour despite brief hospitalising relapses. Ben had been in hospital for 9 weeks over the summer of 1992, finally coming home over the August bank holiday weekend. In October, he had a relapse and was back in for a few nights, then again in November. These relapses were terrifying in themselves. Sudden agony, ambulances called. Was this going to be the pattern forever? I wondered if we were going to have to resign ourselves to a semi-invalid lifestyle, never venturing too far from home, certainly never too far from medical help. Life shrank a bit, became confined to quarters. I became protective of him, ever anxious, a little fretful. It was like a foretaste of old age. Yet below the surface, something was stirring. When we talked about music again, I was aware of a new kind of determination creeping into the conversation. The change wasn't immediate by any means, but if Ben's near-death experience had taught us anything, it was perhaps the somewhat obvious lesson of not wasting time and energy doing things we didn't want to do or didn't believe in. We had spent the last few years chasing something intangible, a level of success, perhaps, that was forever out of reach. An idea of ourselves that had formed in someone else's imagination, not our own. And we had lost the ability to make our own decisions and stick to them. If Ben's survival and being given a second chance at life meant anything at all, then surely we should wipe the slate clean of all that rubbish and try to settle for ourselves what it was that we wanted. For now, though, we had to wait until Ben's gradual physical recovery could catch up with our sense of being on the brink of something new.
Tracy Thorne was reading from her memoir, Bedsit Disco Queen. It was abridged by Alison Joseph and produced by Allegra McElroy. After the news, Women's Hour asks, what has the EU done for gender equality? Jenny Murray presents Women's Hour in a couple of minutes.
Original British drama on BBC One.
You think it's perfect here?
Shetland is a place of peace and tranquility.
Most people here don't lock their doors and I'd like it to stay that way.
Until murder casts a shadow over the community.
She's been shot.
Two families, one of them wealthy, one of them not, living on top of one another for generations. Now, I can't believe that that hasn't created any tension.
The fact is, 9 times out of 10, victims know their killers.
Shetland, Sunday and Monday night at 9 on BBC One and BBC One HD.